Welcome to ATS Mix.
I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
Well, Dave, you know, I am one of those type of people that grew up watching The Jetsons. Did you ever watch that cartoon show, The Jetsons?
Yeah, I really had a thing for the daughter, Judy.
Oh, really?
Judy.
Now, you see, this is where we kind of differ in our opinion. See, I had a thing for Rosie the Robot Maid.
Especially when she leaned over to dust?
No, but it was because of her dusting that I had a thing for her. I was really looking forward to the future so that I could have my own Rosie the Robot Maid be able to clean up after. Because I got to be honest with you, cleaning is not one of my fortes.
Nor is it mine. Yeah.
And so I was really looking forward to that. And, you know, I thought when you and I were both children and teenagers, you know, we kept hearing about the future and what we had to look forward to. And one of those things was we were going to have those levitating cars that we could fly around in. And also our jetpacks. You know, where's our jetpacks?
Right.
I don't see no jetpack.
No.
We decided to contact a gentleman who might be able to share a little bit more information about that. His name is Daniel H. Wilson. He is the king in robotics, literally. I mean, he's even got master's degrees in robotics. Right. We called him up and said, hey, Dave and I don't know anything about robotics, so share what you know, buddy.
He was just a fun interview. It was, you know, John, you know, I mean, we've done a lot of interviews, and I mean, we've done a lot of good interviews and had a lot of great guests, but this guy is just really a lot of fun. He really was just, he kind of went just whatever direction we wanted to go. He was right there stepping with us.
A nice humorous guy, too, and he had a lot of patience with you and I, too, which was nice.
Which he really needed for me, but not necessarily for you. But, you know, the thing I really enjoyed most about this.
Oh, please tell.
About this show is that this guy is just, I don't know what it is about guys that are really into the MIT mentality. That's not his college. But, you know, I mean, they're just so, it reminds me of that stupid show that's on TV right now with the chick that used to be on something else and the blonde chick, and he's got the two nerd guys. And, I mean, you're sitting there just going berserko because these guys are just so smart, you know. But this guy really is level-headed, which, by the way, you think we ought to tell the membership about what was going on?
Yeah, we might as well tell them.
During the interview process, we kept hearing a beep. And we weren't sure whether it was Daniel's robot beeping beside him or we were being recorded. So we'll let the membership figure out. It's going to be
I'm actually, since he works with military applications, I'm actually leaning towards that. It was probably a recording being done by DARPA or one of the other.
I love that concept.
You know, because, you know, to monitor just to make sure that he's not giving out any privileged information that shouldn't be shared with the public.
Ah, never thought about that. But, you know, he was a great guy. It was a lot of fun. I think everybody's going to have a good time with it.
Dave Rabbit here again with the ATS Mix Show from AboveTopSecret.com. If you love politics and are tired of hearing and reading all that robotic crap that keeps churning out from the mainstream media, then come join me and thousands of people from around the world at AbovePolitics.com. They have political forums for everyone's taste, including U.S. politics, United Kingdom politics, Canadian politics, head-to-head political debates, politics of war. They have a general chit-chat and a freshman forum for you newbies and rookies to the political arena. There's also forums about Mideast conflict, socialism. They have a slugfest, liberalism, conservatism, moderate, and my personal favorite, military and security issues. So if you don't want to be another sheep, and want to be a unique thinker, AbovePolitics.com is for you. Part of the Above Network, LLC. Deny apathy. AbovePolitics.com.
The following is an ATS Mix exclusive interview.
Well, this is going to be kind of an interesting interview, Dave. I think we're going to be diving into a subject matter that you and I have never done that before. Is that correct, or have we talked about this before?
That does not compute.
That would be correct, sir. With that in mind, let's get right to telling who our guest is. His name is Daniel H. Wilson. He earned a PhD from the Robotics Institute of Carnegie Mellon University, where he has also received master's degrees in robotics and data mining. Data mining, I think one of our bosses would be very interested in talking to him about that. He has worked in top research laboratories, including Microsoft Research, the Palo Alto Research Center, and Intel Research Seattle. Daniel currently lives in a fully wired smart house. He is the author of How to Survive a Robot Uprising and Where's My Jetpack? And also How to Build a Robot Army, as I wanted to repeat one of the books that you did, as well as being a contributing editor for that fine publication, Popular Mechanics Magazine. He has a website at www.danielhwilson.com. Daniel H. Wilson being all one word. The ATS Mix Show is proud to have with us Daniel Wilson. Hi, Daniel. How are you, sir?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Well, we're doing pretty good. Well, we appreciate the time. I mean, you know, it's a Sunday afternoon when we actually are doing this show, so we really appreciate you taking time out of a weekend to wrap with us a little bit. So, you know, let's get into this thing. You know, I just have been really amazed at all the things that the Johninator has sent me to hone up on what you are about and everything. But I have one question. We've kind of communicated with emails back and forth. And the question, Daniel, is this. Where's the jetpack that you promised Johnny and I?
Well, you know, they're making new strides in jetpack technology right now. I wrote the book, Where's My Jetpack, because I was wondering the same question, you know. I got to thinking, and I was like, now, wait a minute. I'm apparently an adult here, and it's the future, and I haven't got any of this stuff. So I went out looking for it. And the thing about jetpacks is the very first one was pretty much the last one to be invented, and it was actually way back in the 60s. A guy built one on an Army contract. He was working for Bell Aerospace Systems, and it was basically just a rocket that normally was used on the end of the wingtips of airplanes that fly at really high altitudes. They can't plane off the air. There's not much air up there, so they got to use rockets. So this guy took one and just stuck it on his back and test piloted it himself. And, you know, now there's a true inventor for you. But
right.
What makes him a scientist, actually, is he went ahead and tethered himself to the ground before he did it. So he's thinking ahead. Anyway, the problem is that when you put a rocket on your back, it's really loud, it's really hot, and it burns through all the fuel really fast. And so the Army said this is not going to be useful for those reasons. And unfortunately, there hasn't been much progress since, although people have rebuilt those rocket belts.
I bet something that test pilot would say a lot would be, boy, that really chaps my hide.
Well, you know, they had serious problems. I mean, some of the it's funny to think about, but then you think about doing it for real, and so what happened was the guy who originally invented it broke his knee test piloting it, so we got another person named Bill Souter to fly it, and this was just the kid that mowed his lawn.
Wow.
So we got this kid over here, and he grew up to be a hell of a jetpack pilot, and what they eventually did was, for safety, this thing could only go for about 30 seconds, so they affixed a vibrating buzzer onto the helmet. And whenever the guy had about 5 seconds left, it would start vibrating to let him know it's time to wrap it up or die, you know, pretty much.
And, of course, we know what applications that little vibrating device ended up going into.
Yeah, but I think they sell those on the Internet, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now it's grown to be an Internet business.
Well, in the bio, we were mentioning that you currently are living in a fully wired smart house. Tell us about this smart house, if you would.
Okay, so that information is actually slightly out of date. What happened was I lived in a fully wired smart house when I wrote How to Survive a Robot Uprising, because I was actually a graduate student at Carnegie Mellon. I was doing a robotics degree, and all of my research was based on smart houses that can basically track where you're at and figure out what you're doing in order to predict what you should be doing. And the application there, which I don't think sounds creepy at all, is to monitor elderly people to make sure that they're able to do all the daily activities of living. So these are, or the right. activities of daily living, my fault. Stuff like getting up out of bed and getting dressed and feeding yourself. And so if you've got an environment that can figure that stuff out, it can kind of just make sure that you're following your usual routine. And the real challenge there is not to use cameras.
Sure.
Because as it turns out, when you call Grandpa on the phone and say, "Hey, listen, I'm gonna throw a camera in your bathroom. Are you cool with that?" the answer, you just get a cane upside the head.
It's, sure, sure.
It's not a polite answer at all.
Yeah.
So now, I was my own guinea pig.
Would the smart house also tell you, "Hey, it's time to change your Depends"?
You know, there are some wild inventions out there, and I love it. I love science. I like watching people go in different directions. And the best underwear-related elder care technology I've seen is and this is real, the airbag underpants. And what these do is, I'm not kidding. When you lose your balance and you start to fall, if you break a hip, there's all kinds of research that shows that people get depressed, they get bedridden, they have less social interaction. It can be a death sentence. So people are willing to go to any extreme, and that includes the airbag underpants.
Well, you know, there's a downside to that particular invention. You know, I mean, even nowadays we have all kinds of, especially the elderly gentlemen that are getting up in their age, there's all kinds of products that they have to enhance their elderly love life. So, I mean, you know, if they start, you know, like, leaning down a bit, I mean, they might could really do some serious damage to their partner if they got that airbag thing, right?
When they get loose in the, that's another reason not to have cameras, you know what I'm saying? I want to say, though, that this technology is not about taking away anybody's freedom. It's not about saying, you're too old to take care of yourself, you need a robot. Because the baby boomers are retiring, and they're doing it, you know, with style. They're not playing around. They're not acting like they're elderly. Yeah. They don't want to believe it. And so, but you know, my mom is actually a case manager. She's a nurse that goes out and visits people and figures out whether they're doing their activity of daily living. And then if they're not, she gets somebody in there to fill in the gaps. Wow. And so this is really pretty much what the robotics research is doing. I'm just trying to put my dear sweet mother out of a job.
Yeah. Well, listen, you know, here's the thing that I've just got to ask you about, because a lot of people live in a visual world. That would be the Dave Meister. I'm not a big book reader, never have been, never will be, unless John sends me some notes or something and knows that I don't read and does a masterful job of that.
And it still has to have a lot of pictures in it.
If there's no pictures, I just delete it. But here's the thing I can relate to when we're talking about robotics. And you tell me, Daniel, if this if it's plausible either now or in the future, and that is iRobot, the movie.
You mean the movie?
Right.
Like, so, you know, those humanoid robots are an iRobot. They're the ones. That's the movie where Will Smith is trying to save everybody from a robot uprising.
Right.
Those, I think, are a fairly realistic portrayal of what robots would be like. One thing that cracks me up about that movie, that just kills me, is that these guys are all humanoid robots, and they look really futuristic, right? They've got these transparent shells, and there's this one part where, you know, they all go crazy and start killing everybody because, you know, it's a robot movie, so that's got to happen at some point. And so, but when these robots go crazy, right, the first thing that happens is they've got this LED, you know, a little light, and it starts, instead of glowing like blue or green, it starts glowing red.
Of course.
I got to say, that's a hell of a good design decision, right? Your robots are all going to go crazy and start killing everybody. You want to see those. You want some warning, right? You want that red light. Because that's the scariest thing about interacting with robots is that they don't have, they typically lack, you know, human-like, they don't have emotions. They don't make facial expressions. So it can be hard to predict what they're going to do. And those red LEDs are just, those are just a lifesaver.
Well, you know, in that movie, they were able to pretty much be able to work off of artificial intelligence, per se. What is happening realistically in our world, in the world of artificial intelligence?
Well, like I just mentioned, actually, about how robots typically don't recognize emotions, they don't have emotions, all this stuff that seems really easy for people. And in fact, most of the stuff that you figure out by the time you're five, like you gesture, you can speak, you can... you make facial expressions, you show whether you're happy or sad. This is what robots are figuring out right now with artificial intelligence. And so, and it makes sense too, because, you know, a lot of times in these movies you just see some kind of super intelligent robot. And the fact is, you know what, somebody had to build that, okay? And it isn't freaking easy to build that. What you have to do is you have to focus on solving one problem at a time. So what you have now, you have, you know, at Carnegie Mellon, there's a whole department of people that are focused on figuring out face recognition. And there's another group that wants to do speech recognition. So the robots can figure out who's who and can recognize what you're saying, and they can, you know, and then they go further, right? They got gait recognition. So robots can figure out who you are based on how you walk. And, you know, guess what? Human beings can do that too. We just don't really think about it. And all the stuff we don't think about is usually the stuff that we're so good at we don't ever have to worry about it, because we got a specialized brain figuring out those problems for us, and we don't have to deal with it. So that's really what they're working on, is making these robots capable of interacting with human beings just like human beings do, because that's the best, you know, that's the best interface, right? Typing on a keyboard, what's that? I mean, we were never evolved for that. That's why we all got carpal tunnel syndrome, right? We're evolved to look at each other in the face and talk. Even this, even talking on the phone, that's slightly, you know, that's a little bit outside of what humans are meant for. You know?
Okay, well, let's ask another question that is along the same lines. Do you think we're getting closer to artificial intelligence being able to be to a plateau to where it can learn from its own mistakes?
Well, that is what artificial intelligence does. So it does that from the very beginning. You know, I think that people typically they underestimate where we're at with artificial intelligence. So one example that I like to use is that we don't realize it as the robots are encroaching on our territory. But for instance, you know, it used to be that when you hit the brakes on your car, you pushed a lever that would make your car slow down, right? It was mechanical.
Right, early cars.
Now when you hit the brakes, your brake is just a button. It's like hitting the enter key on your keyboard.
Oh, yeah.
You're hitting a button, and you're telling a machine to brake your car. And then there is a learning algorithm in your anti-lock braking system that has figured out, based on learning, being given examples of different situations it could possibly be in and how to brake without killing whoever's inside the car. And so the car does that.
Yeah.
You know what? And, you know, people, we don't brake our cars anymore. We barely even steer our cars. And we don't know it. We think we're in control. But in reality, there's a machine doing the work. And that shows up, you know, in a lot of different examples and different things we do. And the bottom line is that all of these learning algorithms that are doing anything, whether they're predicting the stock market or deciding what gets shipped where at Walmart, you know, they all learn off of. They learn. They learn off of what they've done before. They learn from human experts called domain experts, and they learn even. They'll learn from stuff that you couldn't even imagine. They'll look at the weather. They'll plug in all these different features just for fun, just to see in case it matters.
Right.
And, you know, and they end up reaching, you know, superhuman levels of precision in very specific tasks.
Right.
But you're not, you know, one's not going to beat you at an argument.
Well, you know, you brought up something that I had never really considered before, but when you were talking about the computer controlling how much you brake and it pretty much just being a button that as you press on the brake, if there was like a massive EMP and it knocked out the computer, do you think it would automatically still go back into manual mode so that we could still then be able to brake?
No. If an EMP went off, which would typically happen if a nuclear weapon went off in the atmosphere, that would be the only way to generate an EMP that would affect like the whole nation. All the cars that are, you know, after a certain date, and I mean like probably, I don't know for sure, I would guess sometime in the 80s, maybe I'm off a lot by that with that, but all of those cars would just stop. They'd be done. Cars today are controlled by an ECU, an electronic control unit. And this is just a central computer that controls all the other subcomputers that control every aspect of a car. So, and this is important because right now there's a lot of work in unmanned ground vehicles, right? So there was the DARPA Urban Challenge recently where these cars with nobody driving except computers with lots of sensors so they could figure out what's going on, they all competed against each other, and they're able to do stuff like, well, you know, you can buy a car right now that'll parallel park. That's you know, that's already available to the consumer. This is prototype stuff, and it was for DARPA. DARPA was funding it, so, you know, they're obviously got military applications in mind. But these things could do anything. They avoid pedestrians. They pass each other. They pass on two-lane roads. They're parking, obeying street lights, all kinds of stuff. And the reason that they're able to do this now is because the researchers can tap right into that ECU, and they can just tell it what to do. They can tell the car to brake. They don't have to build an artificial leg that's going to hit a brake pedal, right? Because that's not even really part of it.
Sure.
And actually, I describe in How to Build a Robot Army, I describe how to convert a regular car, a late model car, into an unmanned ground vehicle if you were going to do it yourself, which was pretty fun interviewing some of the teams that competed in the DARPA Grand Challenge.
Well, I bet that was. I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name, but I think it's Isaac Asimov. Is that it?
Uh-huh.
Now, you're going, uh-huh. Is that right or wrong? You can correct
Isaac
Dave.
Asimov? Yeah, that's how you pronounce his name as far as I know it.
Okay. Right. Well, I don't know. You know, I mean. But anyway, this gets back to everything that I've ever seen portrayed in movies from where they had robotics, Terminator, Robbie the Robot back on Forbidden Planet. I mean, it dates back just on and on and on and on. But there seems to be laws of robotics, and Isaac Asimov talks about three of them, and I'm just going to read these, and then I have a question for you. One, a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Two, a robot must obey orders given to it by human beings except when such orders would conflict with the first law. And three, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. Now, this was actually read verbatim in what the movie we were talking about, iRobot.
Yeah.
So my question is, Daniel, are these laws being implemented in today's robotic technology?
Well, so those laws are in English, and that makes them easy for humans to understand, right? You can't.
Right.
The robot can't hurt me. It has to do what I say, and it can't hurt itself. I mean, that makes sense. It's valuable. You know, you don't want it breaking itself. But the problem is that, let's say, how are you going to, I mean, let me just ask you, let's say you got those three laws, and by the way, I should mention that Isaac Asimov wrote dozens of books all about how those laws could break in really subtle ways.
Right.
Usually were like mystery detective stories. Now, wait. If he couldn't hurt him, but he could hurt
right.
him, and it's two robots, but wait, they share the same brain, and it's like, good
Lord. Oh, yeah.
But so that's really fun to read. But the thing is, let's say you got those three rules, and they're written down on a sheet of paper, and then you got you're looking at a robot across the room from you, and, you know, it's programmed, let's say, to get rid of minds or something. Now, how the hell are you going to take those three rules and put it into the robot? I mean,
Yeah.
So, first of all, in order to do anything like not hurt a human, so blah, 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 the robot would have to be able to recognize a human, and then it would have to be able to recognize a mannequin versus a human. So, really, those laws are going to be useful, and they're useful as like a thought experiment for people. But when you really make a robot, right, and you don't want it to kill anybody or hurt anybody, the very first thing you do is you put a kill switch on it. And that's usually, where you can actually pull out a link of that's connecting the power to the robot. So you either hit a button or you yank something off the side of the robot, and it can't move anymore. And you should also have one that's a radio kill switch so you can kill it from afar. Like, for instance, those DARPA Urban Challenge vehicles. The Oshkosh truck was like 13 tons. This thing was a monster, and they hit the kill switch right before it parked in the front of a building. So this is key. And the other thing you got to do is when you've got these things out there. Well, actually, what's interesting, one thing I'd like to bring up is a lot of times these weapons they're designed to be weapons. These robots, right? So you think about a robot that's going to be in someone's house. Well, clearly you don't want it to accidentally hurt somebody, but what about the ethics whenever you got a robot that's designed to hurt somebody? And so that leads to the second thing that you absolutely have to have is you just weld a human operator right into the not literally weld. That's the term that's used. You put a human in the loop, right? So
right.
If you got a trigger on this robot, it's a human that pulls that trigger, whether he pulls it and he'll pull it remotely, right? And there's recently some stuff. I don't know, in the military, they have the law of armed conflict, right, which decides what you can do and what you can't do in a war. And it's mostly agreed upon. And right now they're really trying to figure this out, right? Because the robots, there's more and more of them out there. And I think recently I was reading something kind of cool. The one guy put forth this idea, a guy at the Naval Surface Warfare Center, put out this idea that robots should only be able to shoot at other machines. So if a robot, if a guy comes running at a robot with an AK-47, the robot shoots the AK-47, right? This seems kind of like equal opportunity, right?
Yeah, really.
We're going to let them go out there and fight each other, and we'll go out there and fight each other. So, anyway, it's a pretty interesting area, you know.
Yeah.
But it's a little more complicated than just a couple sentences.
Yeah.
We have some very, very intelligent members at AboveTopSecret.com, and I found several articles and threads that they had posted on robotics. And one of the things that they were talking about was something called, and here again, this is way beyond Dave and I, called three-dimensional molecular circuits. And I guess, for example, this would be like 1 cubic inch of nanotube circuitry, which would be 100 million times more powerful than the human brain. Do you know if anyone is really exploring this?
You know, I imagine they are. I know there's a lot of research in nanomaterials, right? And I talk about that in the book a little bit. I interviewed this guy who literally takes a single bacteria, and then he's got a robot that's just a little smaller than the bacteria, and he basically hitches the robot up to this bacteria and gives it signals, like chemical signals, to make it move. So this is how he's got a nanorobot moving around. So I wouldn't put it past them that they're doing this. They're compressing more and more computing power into smaller and smaller spaces. And, you know, we've all watched computers just get ridiculously fast. Although, you know, it's weird, Microsoft Word or whatever you use to type,
right,
it's always,
right,
it's just as slow as it ever was. I don't get it, you know. It should be, anyway. So I wouldn't put it past them, but one thing I would point out is that you can't always equate computing power with brain power, because, you know, even though our brain has a certain number of neurons that are firing at a certain speed or whatever, you know, the speed of thought, even if you had just as many neurons and you had just as much, or maybe you had 10 times as much and you had it in a cube of something, well, that doesn't mean it's going to be able to think, you know. It doesn't mean it's going to do anything useful. It just means that it's there waiting to run programs, you know. So you still got to have some poor sap to design the artificial intelligence algorithm that's going to replicate human abilities. And that, arguably, is tougher than building that cube of super brain matter. You know?
Right. All right. Well, you know, I'm gonna continue on with my foray of Ebert and Roper movie review stuff.
Sure.
Because that's what I can identify with. You know, as I say, the book thing, forget it. I know you're gonna know this movie when I say it. But let's talk about Colossus: The Forbin Project. Now, that is an amazing movie for its time, in that it deals with exactly what we've been talking about, the artificial intelligence and the self-learning process. And in this movie, it predicts a supercomputer that is capable of not only self-learning as it goes, but also making decisions and taking the ability to do nuclear war or make a first attack and whatever. And I mean, there's all kinds of movies that took that initial concept and came out after the fact. Do you think we're ever going to get, Daniel, to a point to where we entrust the security of, let's say, the United States, since we're from America, but do you think we're ever going to get to a point where we're going to entrust everything into a computer?
You know, that's a really interesting topic to think about, and I think about that sometimes too, because I've read about that in a lot of different science fiction novels and seen it in lots of movies. But the question is, you know, would you go back and start breaking your own car? Well, I mean, no, because you'd be more likely to get killed, right? The computer's better at it than you are. And so, what about if you had a computer, you had a choice to have a stockbroker that was a machine or a human, but the machine made you a lot more money.
Right.
Well, all right. And so, but every time you do this, every time the machines, every time we create some kind of really great artificial intelligence algorithm that does something that we used to do, but it does it better, well, then we kind of paint ourselves into, you know, we can't compete anymore. And so what I think about is if we had, if we had an AI that could run the government better than we can, but what happens whenever you can't actually understand the decisions that the machine is making, but you just know they're good, right? Then you're in trouble.
Sure.
And this happens all the time, by the way. Right now this happens for, go ahead.
And I was going to say, and very jealous, too.
You know, it only makes us jealous. You know, human beings, you know, if you ask a cheetah how good of a creature a human being is, it'd say, you know, they're pretty crappy. They can hardly run fast. You know, they run real slow. And that's how humans are with intelligence. You know, we judge everything by intelligence because that's what we're good at. And so when robots start thinking, we get pretty we get pretty defensive. But
sure.
What it's going to say is that when you put the machines in charge, when you put them into use, one thing that is actually a really valuable aspect of different machine learning algorithms is you want to be able to choose one that's not a black box. And black box means you put something in, like it senses where it's at, and then something comes out, and it decides to go somewhere or whatever. And if you can't figure out the thought process of the machine, then you're kind of in trouble because you're never going to be able to figure out whether it's making the decisions that it should or if it's malfunctioning or not.
Right.
And
right.
One place where this is kind of already in use is with Caterpillar, right? They're a really big company with they sell all kinds of different tractors and heavy machinery, and they have, you wouldn't believe the number of parts that they have that go into these different vehicles, right? And they don't even have names for them, obviously. They just have numbers for them. But how do they know which parts to order and where to keep them so that when people come in with broken machinery, they can get it fixed? And they don't. They have no idea. They have algorithms that figure it out for them. And whether or not they know how those algorithms really work is questionable, you know, but that company couldn't work without those algorithms. And so if that machine ever went wacko and started throwing parts all over the place, there'd be nothing they could do about it.
Right.
So
you had mentioned earlier about the one gentleman that had come up with the idea about having the robot only be able to shoot another device rather than the human
right.
itself. I'm kind of curious, is DARPA or other military research avenues that are working in robotics, are they trying to come up with something similar to like what Dave had mentioned before about with the robot movie that had Will Smith in it, or say like the Terminator series of movies? Is that a possibility that there could be like a T3 Terminator? And if so, how far along do you think it would be before something like that would be viable?
And if so, how far into the woods do I need to move?
Right, exactly.
Well, you know, in all those movies, what you see are humanoid robots. That's what they're called, bipedal. So they're walking around like people, and they're carrying guns like people. And you know, the only thing is they're made out of metal, and, you know, they're scary as hell. And that's really not... we have robots that can walk around like that, but they're pretty delicate. They're definitely not going to be showing up on the battlefield anytime soon, except in the case of exoskeletons, which is really cool, but not what I'm talking about right now. What you see instead are these Foster Miller Swords robots, which are basically just a little, like a radio-controlled tank, kind of,
right.
a little bit more lightweight. Those are the only land-based weapons that I know that are autonomous, that, you know, have a gun, and they don't look much like people, and they're completely radio-controlled by a human operator. But there is this mandate that came from Congress in 2001 that says, hands down, no argument, the U.S. military is going to be composed of a certain number of robotic autonomous units by some certain date in the future. I don't have all the details memorized, but the Future Weapons Program, I think, is what it's called. And this is why DARPA is funding the Grand Challenge, where you've got cars that can drive themselves, because they want ambulances that are going to go out into battle and pick up soldiers, you know. There's there's this really awesome robot called the Bear Robot, and it is basically a humanoid torso with a big friendly face, because that human touch, you know.
Right.
And it's got tank treads for legs. And what it's good at is scooping, well, so far just mannequins, but it scoops mannequins up. When they're laying there hurt, you know, it picks them up, it cuddles them, and it carries them away, right? And then these are the kinds of
I read about
that are going
that.
Out there.
I read about that. Aren't they developing that for military casualty scenarios?
Yeah, that one is under direct development for that. Now, there are two or three other robots that are almost exactly the same, and they're designed to pick up, help people transfer. If you are in a wheelchair, and let's say you're paraplegic and you're in bed, you need to transfer from bed to the wheelchair.
Right.
Well, it's a lot easier to have a robot that can pick you up instead of using a... now they have all types of other really awful devices for doing that.
Right. But the great thing about that is that you don't have to feed them and you don't have to listen to their smack talk, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, you just put
like
them in
some of these nurses' aides. Let's go into cryogenics. This is something that has always just really amazed me, the concept of cryogenics and the concept of the thing. And I guess, here again, staying with my picture mode, the Austin Powers series where he's frozen in cryogenics comes to mind is one of the most recent movies that discusses cryogenic. I mean, there's got to be pros and cons to this, Daniel. What are the pros and cons to cryogenic freezing?
You know, in Where's My Jetpack, I covered all sorts of technology that I thought was impossible and which I found, you know, people had actually tried it and were even doing it. And cryogenics was one of the few of them out there that I did not turn out to be a big fan of. The main reason is that cryogenics is a proto-science. And this is an interesting term that I came across while I was reading about it. And a proto-science is a science that they say we'll figure it out in the future. It's kind of a, we'll freeze you now and take your check, and then we'll figure out how to thaw you out in the future. But call me crazy, like if I have a contractor come over and work in my house, like I don't pay him up front, right?
Right.
Wait till the job's done, because there's no guarantees. So in this one, it's like they're talking about we're going to cut your head off and freeze it, which is called neurosuspension. And interesting side note, it is illegal to perform a neurosuspension until after the person's dead, because otherwise it's just called beheading.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow, you mean the guillotine things? You can't do that?
Not to a living person.
Oh, shucks. Well, there goes next weekend, John. We're going to have to come up with some kind of other entertainment.
Is that what you guys are up to? You had that plan?
Yeah, we're going to interview a Frenchman.
I'm macheteing. Come out there with you guys and hang out.
Yeah, we're going to do a French, we're going to do a transgression of life background or whatever.
You said you weren't really into it. That wasn't something that you necessarily would want to do yourself. Right. But let's say it did happen, all right? Let's say that you did get yourself frozen. What year would you want to be awakened in?
That's an interesting question. You know, everything changes so fast that I would not be... I'd want to pick a year that was maybe just, like maybe 50 years tops, because I don't really know. I don't think I would be able to acclimate if I went much further than 50 years, you know? Because if you're in this situation where you're thinking about how far into the future do I want to go, well, just, you know, you can do that if you just think about, well, what if it was 1930 and I winked out of existence until, you know, 2000? What would be the differences? And they're significant.
Sure.
You know, I mean, with cars and all the transportation differences and everything. So I think maybe I'd just shoot for maybe 2100 tops.
So you would want to go forward, right?
Yeah, you know, I would. I would want to go forward just because I'm so curious, and I've already read a lot about the past, even though I wish that I had been around to ride in a Zeppelin or... you know, be around when flight started. I mean, geez, so many momentous things happened. You know, it's amazing. It's all been clustered.
Well, you know, this is, I think this is interesting that you want to go forward. Johnny, what would you want to do? Go forward, backwards? What year would you want to be woken up in?
Actually, you know, I'm one of those type of people that is just glad not to see his name in the daily obituary column of the newspaper.
So, in other words, you want to just have your head frozen and just leave it there for other people to admire. You don't want to be woken up at any time.
Anything that gets colder than my feet at night, I don't really like.
Or your beer. Okay, well then I'll give you my assessment. You know, as much as I, Daniel, kind of a lean towards what you're saying about going on to the future, you know, I think I would want to go back a bit. I think in the past it was a much simpler life than it is right now. I'm 59. I don't know your age, but I'm 59. I know I'm older than you. I just think that today is just more hectic than it was as I remember growing up as a kid. And I mean, I was really a 60s kid. I kind of liked the 60s as an example. But, you know, I think it has I think it would be difficult for you to make a decision on cryogenic freezing, like when to wake me up. I think that would be a difficult choice.
I think you nailed it on the head. It doesn't matter when you're alive as long as you're a kid.
Yeah.
Just take me back to about 8 years old and I'll be happy wherever you stick me.
Oh, yeah, to where you didn't have to have a job. You could sit there and play and endless summer. An endless summer. I love that concept.
Of course, you don't want to be a kid maybe like in Industrial Revolution London. You know, cause,
right.
You'll be hitting a work day that would make you cringe now.
Oh, no, I just woke up and it's the Black Plague.
Yeah, got to go to work now, too.
That's right.
Pass that hat.
I'll be out all day moving some dead bodies. Thanks. Well, listen, we've pretty much kept you for quite a while, and we certainly do appreciate your time that you shared with us. But before we let you go, why don't you tell us what the most interesting thing in robotics is that you are personally keeping an eye on with great interest and enthusiasm?
Oh, okay. Actually, I started to talk about this a little earlier, so it's perfect. I get a chance to bring it up now. Exoskeletons. So
yes.
This is an area, this is basically a robot that you step inside. You know, it looks kind of like an empty human. You know, you get in there, it's got arms and legs, and then they become your arms and legs. It's a lot like the movie Aliens, where Ripley gets into that big yellow loading machine and fights the alien queen.
Right, well, right, right.
Those things are real, and what's great about it, you know, human beings can do anything, but really the only things they do are things that are going to make money. That's kind of my feeling. So
yeah.
The exoskeleton's great because it's got military it's got medical applications, military applications, it's got all kinds of applications, so all kinds of people are working on it. They're making really great advances. And, you know, just recently Sarcos finished a prototype for DARPA of a diesel-powered exoskeleton that's full body. So you step into this thing, and they got a soldier that's picking up, he's wearing this thing. It's got a big loud engine, you know,
right,
underneath his butt. And he's walking around picking up heavy ammo containers and just slinging them around like they were, you know, empty boxes. And then, of course, there's in Japan, they've got the HAL 5 exoskeleton, which is electric powered. It's real quiet. It's rated for indoor use. You, of course, can't take the Sarcos exoskeleton inside.
Right.
It'd be against the law. You kill everyone with carbon dioxide. Anyway, the HAL 5, a guy took another guy and put him on his back and hiked to the top of a mountain with this thing. I mean, it's pretty amazing. And to think about being able to augment your physical abilities, you know, hey, I'm a skinny nerd. I want an exoskeleton.
And this is diesel-powered, right? Diesel-powered?
There's another one at Berkeley, actually, was funded under the same contract, and it's electric, I think. It's just lower leg. But, yeah, in order to meet the military requirements, it had to be powered by diesel.
Wow.
Interesting.
So that is, a diesel-powered scissor kick. That's going to that's going to end the war right there.
Really? Well, listen, Daniel, we're going to, when we put the show up, we're going to also include a thread to your website, which I want to give everybody right now, which is www.danielhwilson.com. That's, for those that can't spell, DanielhWilson.com. Boy, I tell you, I have really looked forward to this, and it did not disappoint. What a marvelous individual you are, Daniel, and Johnny and I just can't thank you enough for giving us some of your invaluable time and your expertise in robotics.
Yeah, I love talking robots, so call me anytime.
Well, you can count on it, brother. So if you would stay on the line, we want to say goodbye to you off air. So that does another ATS Mix show with this guest of Daniel H. Wilson, robotic genius extraordinaire. So on behalf of the ATS Mix show, AboveTopSecret.com, and the Above Network LLC, I'm Dave Rabbit.
And I'm Johnny Anonymous. We'll catch you next time on the ATS Mix. Hey everyone, Johnny Anonymous here. Just wanted to let you know that after a long day of denying ignorance at the above top secret area, or denying apathy at the above politics area, I like to go to the below top secret arena and just have some fun denying boredom. It doesn't matter if I'm in the mood to just chit-chat with some of the other members and friends or share a good joke, I can do that and so much more in the below top secret forum. In fact, I just got a great recipe for marinating steaks in the food and cooking arena. It was so good that my lady friend just couldn't believe that I found it on that website. You found that at BelowTopSecret.com, she asked? Yes, my dearest, I replied. At BelowTopSecret.com, it's like a one-stop shop of fun and information. They've got areas like travel, health and wellness, music, literature, entertainment, art, and sports. They even have sections that you can rant in, talk about your faith and spirituality, learn about the coolest websites on the net, or even just talk about your latest relationship. Or maybe you're more into breaking news events, urban legends, or even an area that offers you some help on fixing that broken down DeSoto your dad has collecting dust in his garage. Well, friends, I've got to tell you that I've got her hooked, and now she and her friends all go to BelowTopSecret.com and hang out in the numerous areas on the forum. So if you're looking to deny boredom, maybe you should stop by www.BelowTopSecret.com and start having some fun, too.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.AboveTopSecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. Thank you.